from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Tonight on All In.
We got a knock on the door in the morning. I went to the door. There are three FBI agents.
He's a key figure in Trump's attempted coup who sought a pardon in the wake of the insurrection.
Mr. Perry asked for a pardon, too. I'm sorry. Mr. Perry, did he spell that to you correctly? Yes, he did.
Now Congressman Scott Perry is responsible for the oversight of the federal government.
I think there's a different sheriff in town. I think you're going to see a lot of subpoenas.
Tonight, Congressman Adam Schiff on the chaos of the MAGA Congress. Then, the latest on the election denier accused of orchestrating a campaign of violence against Democrats. The DA prosecuting the case will join me live. Plus, involuntary manslaughter charges for Alec Baldwin. Why the prosecutor thinks she can prove criminal negligence. And why there's new reason to be skeptical when George Santos says, I am not a drag queen and I did not let a dog die. And All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. The new MAGA Republican Congress, led by Speaker Kevin McCarthy, is vowing to give the White House some serious headaches. So far, the Biden team is responding in a perhaps unexpected way, with barely restrained glee. Political reports that in the wake of the news, the House Republicans are installing some of their most incendiary conservatives on the Oversight Committee. Privately, the president's aides sent texts to one another with digital high fives and likened their apparent luck to drawing an inside straight. One White House ally called it a, quote, political gift. Now, that might seem like a counterintuitive reaction, but there's a certain logic here. The Oversight Committee, which will undoubtedly be using its power to investigate the president and his family, will now be filled with some of the most toxic and polarizing members of the Republican Party. The new roster includes Jim Jordan of Ohio, Paul Gosar of Arizona, Marjorie Taylor Greene, of course, of Georgia, and Lauren Boebert of Colorado. By the way, those last two have beef of their own, reportedly resulting in a near screaming match in a women's bathroom just off the House floor earlier this month. And some Democrats are thinking that putting these individuals on display in this high-profile role will be to the White House's benefit in the end. Of course, it remains to be seen if that's the case, but it's not a crazy idea. And one of the many strange things about this current Republican caucus is that while there are certain members who crave and seek out attention at all costs, those like Green and Boebert and Matt Gaetz, there are others whose politics are just as odious but have remained pretty far off the radar. And probably the best example is another new member of that same oversight committee, Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania. This will now be the highest profile role Perry ever had, although he has been a member of Congress for a decade. For most of that time, Perry made only occasional headlines, usually when he promoted baseless conspiracy theories. For example, in 2017, he claimed a journalist was exaggerating the severity of the damage in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. The following year, he suggested that ISIS was involved in the mass shooting in Las Vegas. In 2020, he voted against formally condemning the QAnon conspiracy theory and spread lies about COVID vaccines, claiming they were not approved by the FDA, which obviously, and of course, they were. It's a weird thing to lie about. In the aftermath of the 2020 election, behind the scenes, Scott Perry was one of the key plotters of Donald Trump's attempted coup. He worked with the White House to try to throw out the election results in his home state of Pennsylvania, which, of course, Donald Trump lost. In fact, then acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue testified about this in front of the January 6th committee.
At the outset of the call, Congressman Perry told me that he was calling at the behest of the president.
What did he want to talk about?
He wanted to talk about Pennsylvania in particular. He gave me some background about, you know, why he in particular doesn't trust the FBI and why the American people don't necessarily trust the FBI. And then he went into some allegations specific to Pennsylvania, which included, amongst others, this allegation that the Secretary of State had certified more votes than were actually cast.
Perry also tried to sell the White House on a series of other baseless conspiracy theories. Texting, for instance, Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows on New Year's Eve 2020 about Italian satellites switching votes from Trump to Biden. Perry suggested, quote, why can't we just work with the Italian government? He also texted Meadows about his efforts to set up a forensic cyber team that suggested seizing voting machines and putting them under lock and key. According to testimony from Meadows' aide, Cassidy Hutchinson, Perry met with Meadows at the White House multiple times in that crucial winter of 2020 in the run-up to January 6th. And get this, after those meetings, which she said were about, quote, election issues, Meadows burned documents in his office fireplace. Kind of weird. Cassidy Hutchinson also testified about Scott Perry's role in the now infamous scheme to install a low-level Department of Justice official named Jeffrey Clark as acting attorney general in order to draft the DOJ into the coup.
Was it your understanding that Representative Perry was pushing for a specific person to take over the department?
He wanted Mr. Jeff Clark to take over the Department of Justice.
Again, take a step back for a second. Why is a random Republican member of Congress attempting to decapitate the leadership of the Department of Justice and install a friendly Trump supporter to wield the power of the federal government to overturn an election? But that's apparently what Scott Perry was doing. That's a weird thing to be doing as a member of Congress. After all of that, and this relates to the next point, Perry asked the Trump White House for a preemptive pardon.
And are you aware of any members of Congress seeking pardons?
Mr. Gohmert asked for one as well.
And
Mr. Perry asked for a pardon too. I'm sorry, I need to finish.
Mr. Perry, did he talk to you directly?
Yes, he did.
Okay, well that's, I mean, credit where due. That makes some sense. The Italian satellite switching votes, not so much sense. The FDA didn't approve the vaccine, not so much sense. Asking for a pardon after you did what Scott Perry did, there's some logic there. Because Scott Perry is so directly implicated in the engineering of the coup. In fact, he's so directly implicated, and you don't have to trust me on this, that in August, the FBI seized his cell phone. The January 6th committee also issued Perry a subpoena, which he ignored, and then recommended that he face a formal ethics inquiry. But now the Republicans are in charge in the House. Scott Perry is going to have his star turn on the Oversight Committee, where he plans to issue a lot of subpoenas.
Will you subpoena Hunter Biden?
I sure hope so. Yeah, I sure hope so. I will tell you, I have served for my period of time, and I will tell you this. Under Republicans, there hasn't been one subpoena that I know of. Under Paul Ryan, we were begging him to subpoena over the Trump-Russia thing, and he would not do it. I think there's a different sheriff in town that's going to be led by Jim Jordan. I think you're going to see a lot of subpoenas.
This is, I think, what the White House is hoping will happen. I mean, not the subpoenas so much, but that the new House will elevate not just the usual bunch of extremely polarizing, toxic Republican figures, but they will also be introducing America to a new crop of lesser-known extremists who now get to meet and greet the people. Joining me now is Congressman Adam Schiff, Democrat of California, a member of January 6th committee who investigated his colleague Scott Perry's role in the coup. Congressman Schiff is also the former chair of the Intelligence Committee, a group that Speaker Kevin McCarthy has vowed to remove him from now that Republicans hold the majority. Congressman, I want to talk about your role on the Intelligence Committee. Before we get to that, I want to ask about Scott Perry. What do you think about him being on this very important oversight committee?
Well, it would be absurd in any other circumstance, but it is sort of par for the course with Kevin McCarthy. He's beholden to the Scott Perrys and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Lauren Boberts. He'll give them the committees they want. He'll put them in prominent positions, because if he loses any one of them, they could take down his speakership. So not a surprise. The White House may very well be right. This may be good for them because they will show their excess from day one by putting these crazy people on the oversight committee. It will discredit the very committee and any investigation they do. But for the country, it's going to be a terrible circus. They're going to do what they can to interfere with the Justice Department investigation of Donald Trump and his enablers in these multiple lines of effort to overturn the election, and have someone who's implicated in it all, like Perry, being one of those You know, it reminds me a lot, frankly, of the Republicans during the Russia investigation, during the Ukraine investigation. Now, they essentially were acting as defense counsel for Donald Trump. It's going to happen again.
On the question of subpoenas, there's an interesting set of facts here, right? So Scott Perry himself was subpoenaed, which he defied. He's now promising many subpoenas of his own. You've been on this program before talking about the need to basically increase the enforceability of congressional subpoenas. But of course, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right? They now control the House. How do you see the power of subpoenas playing out and the notion of people that themselves defy congressional subpoenas being in on issuing them to other people?
Yeah, well, there's no shame. There's no realization of the hypocrisy of what they're about to do. But this is a constant challenge that we face, and that is we have to point out the falsehood of this effort at equivalence. Because Democrats conducted legitimate investigations of things like Donald Trump's role in January 6th and the role of many others, it doesn't justify somehow Republicans engaging in just vexatious litigation or oversight meant to harass the Biden administration. Endless hearings about Hunter Biden's laptop, for example. There is no equivalence. We were attacked on January 6th. There were multiple lines of effort to overturn the election. It is not the same thing as what Republicans are about to do. So I think it's going to be important for us to point out what is legitimate and what is illegitimate and not let them blur the distinction into trying to claim, well, we're just doing what the Democrats did.
In terms of this kind of equivalence or tit for tat, right, one of the places you see this is with committee assignments. Democrats have voted to strip both Paul Gosar and Marjorie Taylor Greene of their committee assignments in the wake of either new comments they made or revealed comments they made, sort of advocating violence, saying that Nancy Pelosi had committed treason, which is punishable by death. Paul Gosar issuing a video that showed himself murdering his colleague, AOC. In response, Kevin McCarthy has promised to target several Democratic lawmakers, chief among them you, and remove you from your current role on the Intelligence Committee. How does that work? Can he do that?
He may very well be able to do that. It's a select committee rather than the usual kind of standing committee in the House. So he may or may not even need to bring it to a vote on the House floor. But again, this is Kevin McCarthy bowing to the most extreme elements of his conference. And in order to get the support of Marjorie Taylor Greene, he had to promise retribution. But I think in the bigger scheme of things, what's more important is they're going to engage in this bogus investigation process that they're going to call oversight. It is not oversight. But at the same time, they want to try to remove Democrats from key positions to prevent them from effectively fighting back. McCarthy doesn't like what I did in holding Trump accountable. He doesn't like what I do in holding him accountable. The same is true of my colleague on the Intelligence Committee, Eric Swalwell. So there's this effort, I think, to try to decapitate those who would hold them accountable and responsible by removing them from committees. That's a big part of the equation, too.
So I think there's two ways to view the Oversight Committee and broadly oversight activities of the Republicans. One is that this could produce real political harm because it can create this sort of endless churn of stories, which, and again, they might uncover some actual wrongdoing. I don't want to put that outside the realm of possibility. I don't know. But the other is that basically the truth will out, right? So the other way to think about it is the way that the Durham counter investigation ended up happening, right? That for all of the segments on Fox News he was able to deliver, and that's no small thing when you're trying to make an hour of cable news every night, he was not able to actually produce anything at all, and the whole thing was a flop. Like, which of those two do you think are more likely here?
Well, I think that almost immediately they will overplay their hand. They will make sensational allegations, which they will not be able to prove because they're simply untrue. So, yes, I think you're exactly right. It will be fodder for the Fox News machine. It will be fodder for some of their right-wing base, which is all they care about and all they play to. But at the end of the day, it will be a lot of storm and fury signifying nothing. And I think it is probably the quickest ticket to the end of their majority. This is one of the narrowest Republican majorities in history. It's also going to likely be the shortest Republican majority in history, particularly if they put, these kind of circus characters and clowns on these important committees.
You're obviously from California, represent parts of Los Angeles and Southern California. The senior senator from your state, Dianne Feinstein, would be 91 were she to run for re-election in 2024. Many people anticipate she will not do that. Katie Porter has announced that she will be running for U.S. Senate. There's been reporting that Barbara Lee, another member of the House California delegation from Northern California, Oakland, might run as well. And there's been reporting that you will throw your hat in the ring. Are you planning a run for Senate?
You know, the focus I've had over the last few weeks has been really on our storm, and I'm grateful the president came out today to survey the damage. That's where all of our focus should be while our fellow citizens in California have been suffering. Happily, the storm is coming to an end. I will have more to say on this subject soon, but I've been really focused on trying to make sure that I protect my constituents and others around the state from the ravages of climate change.
All right, Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you.
Coming up, the ongoing threat of MAGA violence in America. The district attorney who's overseeing that case against the New Mexico Republican politician who's charged with a string of political shootings aimed at Democrats will join me next. Don't go anywhere. The ultra-Trump fan who prosecutors say was behind a series of shootings targeting local Democratic politicians in New Mexico remains in police custody tonight. There's a hearing scheduled for Monday to determine if he should be released while he awaits trial. Solomon Pena is accused of hiring a group of men to shoot at the home of two Democratic state senators and two county commissioners. Prosecutors say it was part of a politically motivated revenge scheme inspired by Pena's stated belief in Trump's big lie of rigged elections and his own failed bid as a Republican candidate for a state House seat back in November, a seat, by the way, he lost by 50 points. Now, miraculously and against the odds, no one was hurt in the attacks, even though prosecutors say Pena ordered his accomplices to, quote, aim lower to have a better chance of shooting someone. Joined now by Sam Bregman. He's the Bernalillo County District Attorney, whose office will prosecute the case against Pena. Mr. Bregman, it's good to have you on. First, I guess I want to ask about whether everyone involved in this alleged plot has been apprehended and taken into custody.
Everybody has been identified. Two are in custody. One's in Mr. Pena's in state custody. One's in federal custody. And we know the other two individuals involved, two brothers.
So you're presumably you're trying to find them, yes?
Well, we know where they're at. We know where they're at. We're confident. We're putting together various things, and I can't get into the investigative part of it necessarily right now. But I'm very confident that everybody involved in this is not able to be involved in it anymore right now.
Was this a difficult case in terms of figuring out who had done this, or was it quite obvious once you started looking at the evidence that it was Mr. Pena, as your office says?
Well, the pieces of the puzzle came together. I will say that the Albuquerque Police Department and their detectives did a tremendous job, as well as some of the prosecutors in this office who worked night and day. This kind of attack on elected officials' homes, obviously. The one common denominator of these folks are their elected officials, and it is really unacceptable to take your politics to such an extreme that you use violence, and we won't stand for it.
Do you have a sense of how serious Pena was about these attacks? Whether, and there's some court filings to indicate this was to scare people, whether this was to injure or maim people. Or kill them.
Many of the facts are detailed in the criminal complaint that's already been filed and is a public document. But I can tell you this. Here's a guy, Mr. Pena, that paid $500 to four other people to start shooting at elected leaders' homes. He provided the addresses and text messages of which homes to shoot. He participated himself, we know, in one of the shootings. Based on the whole amount of evidence that we have, I'm very confident that the political motivation is clear in this as well. And it's when you take political rhetoric to such an extreme, whether or not it's Republicans or Democrats, left or right, when you take it to such an extreme that the next step is violence and you don't care about the rule of law, That's it's just so unacceptable. Now, you asked me what was the purpose. Well, I can tell you this much. This kind of conduct was, and it does, it has an effect of intimidating elected officials, terrorizing elected officials, traumatizing elected officials and their families. And it's important to note, one of the homes was shot up was a state senator. The other one was actually the Speaker of the House for this, for the state of New Mexico in the state house. And here's the point. we're a citizen legislature. These folks go up, give their time 30 or 60 days a year, depending on what year it is. They have to go up to the Santa Fe, do their job, do the people's business, and they leave often their families back in whatever part of the state they live in. And how does that make them feel when they go up there and do their job, when this kind of violence is taking place? It's really a shame. And when we have overblown rhetoric, as we do in our politics, unfortunately, sometimes people take it to another extreme and they attempt to try and act out their sick political fantasies with violence. And it's just so long. We're not going to take it here in Albuquerque. We're going to make sure that we do justice.
Your point about the citizen legislators, I've talked to State Senator Linda Lopez, for instance, the attorney general for the state. I mean, this is true even up to members of Congress, and largely true of senators. And most elected officials don't really have security. I mean, they're just around. It's certainly true of county commissioners. It's certainly true of folks in the state house. Right. But it's generally the case that the way this whole thing works, democracy, a free and open society, is that, like, that's how it is. They talk to people. They're not behind barricades and things like that. Do you think there's a way of getting that back after something like this happens?
Well, one way of doing it is prosecuting anybody that it gives the middle finger, if you will, to the rule of law and does these kind of terrible things, outrageous things, as is in this instance. But you're right. I mean, our democracy is built on the idea that we send folks up there that represent us and do the people's work. And that's real, real hard in the back of their mind if they're worried about their families and they're being terrorized like this. So it's got to come to an end, and we're going to do everything we can to prosecute this to the fullest extent of the law. And of course, he's innocent, and until and unless we unless he's found guilty in a court of law. But the important part, I think, to recognize is that this is a direct attack on democracy, as you said, and it's unacceptable.
All right, Sam Bregman, who is the district attorney there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still ahead, new reports of Republican Congressman George Santos's lies basically come by the hour. So how did New York Democrats miss this during the election? Democratic Congressman Richie Torres joins me right here next. So if you want to know how it's going for freshman Republican George Santos in today's installment of the Santos Files, here's a headline from our local NBC station on the New York Congressman. I'll just read it verbatim. Quote, George Santos, I am not a drag queen. I didn't let a dog die. Here with me in the studio tonight, one of the multiple members of the New York congressional delegation calling on Santos to resign, New York Democratic Congressman Richie Torres. Congressman, it's good to have you here in studio.
Of course.
It seems like I think a majority probably the New York delegation has called on this, right? Multiple Republican members certainly have. I think a bunch of Democrats have. Are these falling on deaf ears? Like, he's saying he's not going to go anywhere. But do you think do you think there's sufficient pressure that it could happen?
I suspect he will cling on to the bitter end unless forced to do so by the U.S. attorney. Right. If he were indicted, he could agree to resign as part of a plea bargain. But absent law enforcement, it seems like he's intent on clinging on. And frankly, Speaker McCarthy, who needs every vote he can get, needs George Santos to remain in power. Like, House Republican leadership, which has been protecting Santos, has no incentive to drain the Santos swamp.
Notably, in that New York delegation, you've got the frontline members who have won, like George Santos, who have won districts Joe Biden carried, right, who are up for re-election, who will be the highest profile Democratic targets, calling for him to resign. Elise Stefanik in Republican leadership is not. Why do you think she's making that decision?
Well, there's a disconnect between local Republicans who have heard directly from the voters and who have called upon Santos to resign, versus Elise Stefanik. There was no greater booster of George Santos than Elise Stefanik. She not only enthusiastically endorsed, but fundraised for George Santos in the tune of $100,000. And ever since his fraudulence has come to light, she has been deafeningly silent. And there's reason to think that House Republican leadership knew about the fraudulence of George Santos and simply turned a blind eye and is now doubling down.
There's a broader context here of the Democratic Party in New York State, okay? The Democratic Party in New York State probably had one of the worst nights on election night of any Democratic Party. Maybe the Florida Democratic Party was up there, too. And George Santos seems like the apotheosis. At one level, you're like, how did this happen, right? And there's lots of blame to go around and, you know, in terms of reporting. But it does seem like what happened? What is there an after-action report that you as a New York Democrat and other New York Democrats are doing to say, like, how did the election night happen and how did we do so badly that this guy made it into Congress?
Look, the election of a complete charlatan like George Santos, who's almost a caricature unto himself, should be a shock and a jolt to the system. It should be a wake-up call for the Democratic Party in New York State. It's a cruel irony that there was a red wave almost nowhere, except in New York, where we had congressional losses in the Hudson Valley and in Long Island. Part of it was a function of a unique circumstance, right? Lee Zeldin effectively weaponizing the issue of crime in a fiercely contested gubernatorial race. But part of it was a function of something deeper, which was a failure of party infrastructure. And so the key to winning back the majority in 2024 and making Hakeem Jeffries the first African-American speaker is rebuilding the party infrastructure in New York State.
Yeah, and I don't want to be, overly obsessed with my home state. But to your point, in terms of the national stakes here, I think there's four or five flippable seats in the state, right? So, I mean, you're almost back in the majority if you just get back the New York seats. Do you think the state party is engaged in this kind of infrastructure development? Jay Jacobs, who's the chair, has said he's not going to resign. People have called on him to resign. Is there anything happening that would give one faith that, like, the party has learned these lessons?
Look, the New York delegation has...
That was a long pause.
No, the New York delegation has a vested interest. No one has a more vested interest in rebuilding the party than the New York delegation because we want to be back in the majority. And my view is that the Republicans, the far right, the dysfunction, the extremism of the far right poses such a profound threat to our democracy and our economy that we in the Democratic Party have to get our act together and take back the majority. Failure is not an option given what is at stake.
Do you have interactions with your new colleagues on the Republican side? Because it also strikes me that, again, and I've had Brandon Williams on the program,
yeah.
Mike Lawler, Lolota, Desposito, Williams, that crew, interestingly, is probably some of the most cross-pressured members in this new Congress. Because, like, I don't think their voters want them voting to default and, you know, impeach Joe Biden, right? I think they know that, too. The question is, are they going to do anything about it?
Look, there are Republicans who might have moderate instincts, but the energy is on the far right. I mean, Kevin McCarthy is being held hostage by the far right of his party, which is intent on defaulting on America's debt and derailing the full faith and credit of the United States. And it appears to me that these moderate Republicans are passive observers in a hostage-taking crisis. And House Republicans have become the Freudian id of the Republican Party.
How do you think about being the minority this year, like what your job is?
Look, I think our job is to resist the excesses of the Republican Party. And my greatest concern is the debt limit brinksmanship. I mean, if we were to default on America's debt, it would do irreparable damage to the American economy. So I hope that there are six Republicans who would join 212 Democrats to proceed with a discharge petition and do everything we can to raise the debt limit and protect the American economy.
Are those active right now? There's back and forth. The White House saying they're not negotiating, which I understand. They're saying, like, we don't negotiate on this. You just pass it. Are there active conversations on that people have talked about? One way out of the crisis is a discharge petition. Discharge petition, for those who don't know, is basically a privilege motion that brings something to the floor with a majority of members signing on to it. It can move very slowly. It can be sometimes this plot device that's more invoked than actually utilized. But are there active discussions about that?
Not yet, but there might be a hope. Look, remember, Mitch McConnell was intent on debt limit brinksmanship and then capitulated in the 11th hour. It could be that Kevin McCarthy does the same, but no one should underestimate the obstructionism of the House Republican majority. If House Republicans are willing to engineer a historic humiliation of their own leader, Kevin McCarthy, then I think they're willing to derail the full faith and credit of the United States.
Which perversely gives them more negotiating leverage. Right. I mean, isn't that part of the problem? Like, they want us, everyone, you, to think that they're going to do it, that they'll pull the trigger.
But I actually think they will.
Well, right.
I mean, I think they're arsonists who are intent on burning everything around them including their own leadership and the full faith and credit of the United States.
To get back to Santos, whose vote is needed, and, you know, the funny thing about Santos, too, is it's a +8 Biden district.
Yeah.
So, like, to the extent that he's listening to any political incentives, like, he has incentives to not do crazy stuff either. Do you suspect that he's going to be able to be there long enough to play any role in that?
Look, if he had any integrity, he would resign, because his ability to govern has been crippled by a complete collapse of credibility. He has no credibility with his colleagues, and he has no credibility with his constituents. And so if he were to resign, it would be the only honorable thing he did in an otherwise dishonorable public life.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that, what you know, of all these stories, what I find sort of most human and fun and relatable is that he would like to do drag and had friends.
He's diversifying the House Republican Conference.
Well, that was his whole thing. And now he's saying that, you know, and he's denying that his most that it's an obsession, that, of course, it's a lie. And there's a picture of him. And it's like, well, you might as well just tell the truth about this one. Congressman Richie Torres.
You should own it.
It's good to have you here. Still to come, who leaked Justice Samuel Alito's draft opinion on the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade? The result of the Supreme Court's investigation raised more questions than it answers. Next. Back in May, nearly 2 months before the Supreme Court released its official ruling in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, with the future of abortion rights in the balance, a draft of the opinion was leaked to Politico, which it published. The draft opinion overturning Roe was written by conservative Justice Samuel Alito, and it ended the constitutional right to an abortion in the United States. Now, this draft leak was a seismic moment in American politics on two levels, right? It was a tremendously unpopular decision, the actual substance of it, the overturning of a constitutional right 50 years after it had been enshrined, as we eventually saw reflected in the midterm election results. But also, the fact of the leak itself was seismic. So conservatives chose to focus on that. Instead of focusing on the consequences of their decades-long project to end abortion rights, instead, conservatives found it convenient to vent their spleen at the leaker, the fact of the leak, ranting on and on about the sanctity of the court and what a massive betrayal of trust the breach was.
It was a grave betrayal of trust by somebody, and it was a shock because nothing like that had happened in the past. So it certainly changed the atmosphere at the court for the remainder of last term.
I would also humbly submit that taking away women's rights to control their bodies probably changed the atmosphere of the court, too. Now, conservatives like Alito and others just took it for granted that a liberal was behind the leak, or at least they pretended to publicly. And we should say that's entirely a plausible theory, that the decision was leaked by a liberal working at the court who was furious about it and wanted to raise awareness of the impending decision or kind of just blow the whistle, no matter how ineffectually. But of course, it's just equally plausible the decision was leaked by a conservative. And one of the possible, most likely motives, if it were that, would be to box in the justices who joined that opinion going all the way in overturning Roe if they were worried that one of those justices might be getting cold feet, might be looking for a way to do something not quite as radical. And here's the thing. In fact, just days before the draft leaked, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, a notoriously right-wing editorial page, published this strange editorial that implied that Chief Justice John Roberts was getting cold feet about the decision, or he was trying to attract maybe one of the other members over to join him in a kind of like Solomonic half decision. So it's also entirely possible the draft was leaked for a different reason that has nothing to do with any of this, and we may never fully understand. But for the better part of a year now, the court has been, quote unquote, investigating the source of the leak. That's what Chief Justice John Roberts said. And the intervening months, we've also learned something interesting, because back in November, the New York Times published a letter from an anti-abortion activist to Chief Justice John Roberts. The man has since recanted his previous views. And he claims that Justice Samuel Alito himself leaked the decision of a 2014 court decision limiting access to birth control. That's something Alito denies. Well, today, the court seems to have, well, kind of given up on trying to get to the bottom of the Dobbs leak. In a, frankly, strange report released this afternoon, the court's investigators essentially threw their hands up in the air. We looked high, we looked low, we couldn't find the leaker. They said they were not able to find the source of the leak. They even strangely, and for reasons that are as yet unclear to me, included a testimonial from former George W. Bush Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, who basically said, attaboy, you looked everywhere and couldn't find it, praising their failed investigation. Now, the report also says they spoke to 97 court employees, but it is worth noting that it appears investigators didn't actually question the Supreme Court justices themselves.
As the actor that pulled the trigger, that's obviously a very compelling fact, but he's also facing charges as a producer because he should have known that the conditions on that set were unsafe. He also should have looked at those bullets or had the armor look at those bullets when the gun was handed to him, and he certainly should have never pointed that gun at Helena Hutchins. Just because something's an accident doesn't mean it's not criminal, and that's what we have here in this case.
Alec Baldwin is now facing two charges of involuntary manslaughter in the shooting death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins. The shooting happened on the set of a low-budget Western in New Mexico 15 months ago. Baldwin, the lead actor and a producer in the film, was rehearsing a scene when the gun he was holding for that scene went off. Hutchins was killed. Prosecutors have now charged Baldwin, along with the film's armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, with involuntary manslaughter, saying they have a duty to ensure the gun was safe. A lawyer for Baldwin said he relied on professionals who assured him there were no live rounds. An attorney for Gutierrez-Reed said the armorer would be exonerated of wrongdoing. Nicole Moss is a criminal defense attorney practicing in New Mexico. Charles Komen is a civil rights attorney and a former prosecutor in the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office, and both join me now. Nicole, let me just start with you. I think a lot of people were surprised, I think, to see this today, partly because people know Alec Baldwin, obviously, is very famous. And also because the entire thing just seems so deathlessly horrible and tragic, and clearly there was no intent, which is not being alleged by the prosecutor's office. So just take us through how surprised you are by these charges and what the standard here is that the district attorney's office has to prove.
Sure. Great question, Chris. I'm actually not that surprised by the announcement. We see a lot of prosecutions in New Mexico that I think are somewhat weak. Basically, for the state to convict either defendant in this case, there's two ways to prove involuntary manslaughter. The first way is when the killing happens during the commission of a misdemeanor offense, such as negligent use of a deadly weapon. And the second way is when the death occurs during a lawful act, which may cause a death. And is done without due caution or circumspection. So basically, when you do something recklessly.
Charles, there's a word that the first assistant director, David Halls, has agreed to plead guilty to the negligent use of a deadly weapon and that he will testify for the state. Obviously, that's not a great thing to hear if you're Alec Baldwin or Ms. Reed and you're plotting their defense. How do you see the core issue before a jury being here? What do you see it as being?
Well, I do think that there is an important piece that the district attorney pointed out in that he's not just being tried or facing prosecution as an actor or as the person who pulled the trigger. He's also facing prosecution because he was someone who was a producer and had a duty and an obligation to ensure safety on the set. And I think that part of why they decided to go forward with the prosecution was that he neglected that duty in a way that ultimately led to the death of another person. The death, albeit an accident, may not necessarily have been intentional, but it was something that he was responsible for in his duties as a producer for preventing. So I think that that's going to be the thing that the prosecutors try to drive home in front of the jury to make them understand we're not just talking about Alec Baldwin, the actor. We're talking about his responsibilities also as a producer as well.
I think it's probably worth playing a little bit of his police interview where he just gives his side of this when apprehended. And again, there's no reason to think he's not telling the truth here. And it's interesting, I think, to think about the facts as presented here and what they would mean for the case. Here he is talking about what happened in the lead up to the shooting.
She disarms me. We go to lunch. We come back from lunch, and they hand me the revolver, the Colt.
And they—I just like so many names. It's Hannah again.
They arm me, and you're assuming, as we've done every time, that it's a cold gun for the rehearsal. She cleans the barrel every time, and she checks that the rounds are all cosmetic rounds, or nothing in the chamber for the rehearsal. She hands me the gun. I'm assuming she's done it the right way. She's done it the last 2 weeks. I put it in the holster. I pull it out slow. We're rehearsing. We're not filming anything. I pull it out, so I turn, cock the pistol, bang, it goes off, and she hits the ground.
Nicole, when you see that as an articulation of what happened, and obviously I think he's going to make the case that the onus wasn't on him, although the fact he's a producer seems like the complicating factor here in what the district attorney's getting at.
Sure, but I think that the issue here is also whether his conduct will rise to the level of a willful disregard for the safety of others. That's what the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and I think they're going to have a hard time here.
Yeah, I have to say, just to take a step back here and just ask a perhaps overly philosophical question, I do feel occasionally whenever I zoom in on what the distinction between a criminal and civil violation is, and indeed between criminal and civil law, I find myself like having a pretty hard time finding a line between them. This seems to me like there would be a very clear grounds for the family of the woman who lost her life in such an awful and tragic fashion to sue for there's clearly some exposure to civil liability. Like, what moves something from one category to the other, Charles?
Well, I don't think that this is a case of either or. I think it's a case of and also. I fully would expect that we will see a wrongful death suit or other civil actions pursued against Alec Baldwin and other members of the staff, the studio, and so on and so forth from the family of the victim here. I think that it is a little bit of a murky line in many cases, but that line itself does not prevent one from going forward in the absence of another. And so even though a criminal prosecution has taken place here, be clear, without this, there still would have been room for civil litigation, and I still would have fully expected the family to move forward and look to actually hold Alec Baldwin and the studio accountable for the loss of their loved one.
In terms of the timeline, it is 15 months since this happened. Obviously, there's no statute of limitations issue that they have here, but it does seem like a long time between the event and the charging decision. What do you think, Nicole?
I think it has been a lengthy investigation. I would have expected that certain questions, such as where the live rounds came from, would have been answered before they would be moving forward with criminal charges. It doesn't sound like that has actually been cleared up at this point.
Yeah, that does seem like a huge part in the sort of causal chain that led to this awful event. Nicole Moss and Charles Coleman, thanks for joining us to fill us in. I really appreciate it. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.